Good afternoon and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us from the Arizona Republic, Testing AI with Common Gardening Questions by Paul Capiello. Having been in the garden business, academic, commercial, and nonprofit for over four decades, I've had the great privilege to learn from, share with, and debate an awful lot of smart and experienced gardeners. But there's new force on the lecture circuit, so I decided to pull on my John Henry of Horticulture hat and go toe-to-toe with an artificial intelligence service to see what would happen. Here's the setup. I asked my new AI colleague, I'll call him Bob, to answer a few common garden questions, and I followed up his response with a few of my own thoughts. Question: what got you interested in gardening? Bob: that's a lovely question, and one that often gets to the heart of why people stay in this field. For me, the spark came from spending time outdoors as a kid. I remember being fascinated by how something as small as a seed could turn into a towering sunflower, or how a bare patch of ground could suddenly be alive with blooms and insects. Later, mentors, whether a grandparent with a vegetable patch, a teacher pointing out wildflowers, or an early boss in a nursery, showed me that gardening isn't just about plants, it's about care, patience, and connection to place. Over time, that curiosity deepened into a professional interest because gardening sits at the intersection of so many things I care about: ecology, design, science, and human well-being. And here's the evaluation. Hard to argue with this one. In fact, I think Bob should teach an intro gardening course for young kids. He sounds like someone I'd love to tag along with on a walk in the woods or garden. Score one for Bob. Next, what's your position on the use of native plants in the landscape? Bob, that's a thoughtful question and one I get quite often. My position is that native plants are a tremendously valuable tool in the landscape, but they're not the only tool. Here's why. Ecological benefits. Native plants support pollinators, birds, and other wildlife in ways that many non-natives cannot. Their deep relationships with local ecosystems make them irreplaceable in sustaining biodiversity. Adaptation and resilience. Many natives are well adapted to local soils, climate, and weather patterns, which can mean less irrigation, less fertilizer, and less pest pressure if sited correctly. Design considerations. The reality is that some landscapes call for certain colors, forms, or year-round structure that may not always be provided by the local native palette. In those cases, I think it's perfectly appropriate to blend carefully chosen non-invasive exotics with natives to achieve both ecological function and design goals. So in short, I strongly advocate for natives as a foundation, but I see the best landscapes as diverse, intentional, and site-specific, rather than strictly native only. And here's the writer's evaluation. Okay, pretty mainline response here, nothing earth-shattering. But I will take issue with the adaptation and resilience part of the answer. Native plants may be well adapted to local soils, but rarely are we planting into undisturbed native soils. Sometimes, an exotic will perform better than many native plants in highly disturbed soils. Native plants do not necessarily require less fertilizer or irrigation than exotics. That's a long debunked factoid. But I do like the diverse, intentional, and site-specific bit and agree with that wholeheartedly. Can you tell me how to prune my hydrangea? Bob, great question. Hydrangea pruning is one of those topics that causes a lot of confusion because different types bloom on different wood. The first step is figuring out what kind of hydrangea you have. Big leaf hydrangea. These bloom on old wood, last year's stems. If you cut them back hard in winter or early spring, you'll lose your flower buds. For these, prune right after flowering. Smooth hydrangea. These bloom on new wood. You could cut them back quite hard in late winter or very early spring, and they'll push up fresh growth that flowers the same season. Panicle hydrangea. These also bloom on new wood. You can prune them back in late winter or early spring without fear of losing flowers. Oak leaf hydrangea. Like big leaves, they bloom on old wood. Best to prune right after they flower. Evaluation. Spot on, Bob. In fact, a couple of parts look astonishingly similar or identical to something I've written in the past, but that's another topic for another time. Finally, are plants sold under a national brand worth the price? Bob, that's a sharp, practical question, one that often stirs debate when gardeners compare a $30 branded shrub to a $15 no-name one at the local garden center. Sometimes the extra price is justified. Sometimes it's just marketing. Why national brand plants can be worth it. Proven performance. Brands like Proven Winners or Monrovia usually trial their plants extensively before release. Uniform quality. National brands tend to have stricter quality controls, so you're less likely to buy a weak or mislabeled plant. Unique genetics. Branded plants often come from proprietary breeding programs. If you want that specific hydrangea or dwarf coneflower, you may only find it under that brand. Why the higher price may not be necessary. Local adaptation. Sometimes a plant grown by a small local nursery or unbranded will actually perform better since it's been propagated and grown under your region's conditions. Basic species. If you just want a straight species oak, lilac, or echinacea, there's no real reason to pay double for a branded pot. Marketing markup. You're partly paying for the pretty pot, the tag, and the advertising. And here's the evaluation. Ouch! Generally, Bob is on track, but for a few doozies. Uniform quality. Yowza! A poor grower will grow a poor plant no matter the genetics or marketing. Good growers grow good plants regardless of genetics. Local adaptation. Nope. This is a particularly bad faux pas. A plant's genetics determine its adaptability. Where the plant is grown is irrelevant. And rarely is the difference between a branded and unbranded plant a factor of two, as Bob suggests in his basic species response. Overall score for our friend and colleague Bob? I'd say B-. Some excellent points, and maybe he's a good place to start when you're looking for answers. But he does perpetuate some old and outdated tropes. Shame on Bob. As with so many things in life, best not to rely solely on Bob. Also from the Arizona Republic, it's time to check and review Heat Management by Bob Hatton. Plenty of areas in the country are still feeling the heat and drought, so now is a good time to check some things and observe your gardens with those conditions in mind. First, check your equipment. If you have an automatic sprinkler system, when was the last time you examined every sprinkler head to be sure that it is aimed properly and not blocked by grass, flowers, or shrubs? Is it spraying properly, or does it need adjustment or a pebble cleanout? Are there hot spots in your lawn or garden? These may show you where to focus. It is safe to say that no matter how extensive your automatic irrigation system may be, it neither covers nor provides the proper amount of water for everything. Check nooks and crannies for areas needing supplemental water. Also, check trees and shrubs planted this year and last to make sure that they have adequate water while they are becoming established. Depending on their size when they were planted, it might take 3 years for them to become established. Smaller plants become established more quickly. If supplemental water is needed, don't just add more time to the zone where some additional water is needed. That will simply waste water where it's not needed and might damage some plants with too much moisture. Should you consider moving some of the plants to another area where they will be with plants of similar water and sun requirements? While we most often focus on new trees and shrubs for adequate moisture, if your area is in a drought, look at your mature trees and shrubs to see if they show signs of needing supplemental water. If they do, water them slowly at and just beyond the drip line of the branches until the water penetrates about a foot. They should not need this treatment often, but might benefit from it to lessen or eliminate stress. Stress plants are more susceptible to disease and insect attack than strong, healthy ones. Have you switched to organic fertilizers and nutrients and perhaps started adding more compost or other organic matter to your lawn and gardens? If so, you may need to change the watering time on some zones. As your soil improves, it retains more water and nutrients, often resulting in less frequent watering and fertilizing needs. Get a soil probe to check the time required to apply the proper amount of water. Do you have areas with high maintenance plants? Plants that require a lot of watering, feeding, or other work? How do they look? Do you like doting over them? Look around at other plants in your and others' gardens for lower maintenance plants that still provide the look you want. Visit any local Extension Master Gardener demonstration gardens for ideas. Swap out the prima donnas with plants more appropriate to your property. All right. For BetterHomesAndGardens.com, 12 plants you should never cut back in fall. Avoid the most common pruning mistakes by not cutting these shrubs and perennials back in fall. By Lauren Landers. Cutting back plants at the right times can encourage fresh growth and increase flowering, and can even reduce common plant diseases like powdery mildew. However, pruning plants at the wrong time of the year can actually inhibit flowering and cause other issues. When cleaning up your garden in fall, leaving certain perennials and shrubs intact will help keep these plants thriving for years to come. The following plants should never be pruned in autumn. First on the list, rhododendrons and azaleas. Azaleas and rhododendrons belong to the same plant family, and their pruning requirements are similar as a result. Because these plants flower on old wood, pruning azaleas and rhododendrons in fall will remove their flower buds and prevent the plants from blooming the following spring. To avoid this, only prune azaleas and rhododendrons in late spring to early summer, no more than 3 weeks after the plants finish blooming. Number two on the list of 12 plants you should never cut back in fall, lilacs. Pruning is an essential task if you keep lilac shrubs in your garden, as these plants can get unruly and grow over 30 feet tall if they're not cut back from time to time. However, like rhododendrons, lilacs only bloom on old wood, and pruning plants late in the season will remove the plant's flower buds and reduce bloom intensity. Instead of fall pruning, lilac bushes should be cut back immediately after they finish blooming in late spring to early summer. Number three, forsythia. Like lilacs, forsythia shrubs are fast-growing plants that can quickly overcrowd garden beds if they aren't pruned every year or two. However, these plants only bloom on old wood, and if you prune forsythia in autumn, you risk removing the plant's flower buds. To avoid this, only prune forsythia bushes in spring after the flowers fade, and never cut away more than a third of forsythia branches at one time. Coneflower, number four. Coneflower plants don't necessarily need to be pruned at all, but if you like a tidier garden, it's best to wait until spring to cut coneflowers back. If you leave this perennial's large seed heads intact in fall, they'll provide an important food source for birds in winter and attract other wildlife to your garden as well. Beyond that, coneflower plants also readily self-sow if you don't remove the seed heads, and you'll often get free volunteer coneflower plants if you wait until spring to do your pruning. Number five, globe thistle. Like coneflowers, globe thistle plants produce seed-filled flower heads. During winter, these seeds provide food for goldfinches and other birds, and they help wildlife survive when other food sources are scarce. What's more, dried globe thistle flowers remain upright throughout the winter months, adding texture to flower beds even when there's snow on the ground. Number six is Russian sage. Russian sage plants are prized for their aromatic foliage and purple flowers, which are magnets for bees and other pollinators. However, this perennial plant can be susceptible to winter damage, especially if pruned late in the season. To ensure your Russian sage makes it through the cold winter, mulch your plants well and wait until late winter to early spring to do your pruning. Number seven, black-eyed Susan. Black-eyed Susan is another plant that birds often forage from during the winter months, so leave the dried flower heads in place if you can. Waiting until spring to cut back black-eyed Susan will reduce your fall gardening tasks, and it will also give your flowers more time to self-sow. If you want more black-eyed Susan for your garden, skip fall pruning and allow your plants to seed themselves. Number eight, some hydrangeas. Pruning hydrangeas can be a bit confusing because there's a lot of variety in this plant group. The cold hardy hydrangea varieties that bloom on new wood can be successfully pruned in autumn. However, other hydrangeas like oak leaf, big leaf, mountain, and climbing hydrangeas flower on old wood and should only be cut back in spring or summer after the plant finishes flowering. Next, mock orange, number 9. Mock oranges are famed for their highly scented flowers, and they're often grown in cottage gardens where they pair beautifully with forsythia, viburnums, and lilacs. Low maintenance and easy to care for, mock oranges don't require a lot of fuss, but they're another plant that shouldn't be cut back in fall. Like some of the other plants on this list, mock oranges only flower on old wood, and pruning late in the season will reduce the plant's flower buds and diminish bloom size. Next, lady's mantle. Another cottage garden favorite, lady's mantle doesn't really need to be pruned. In fact, some gardeners allow these plants to grow a bit wild. However, if you want to keep your garden beds looking pristine, avoid fall pruning and cut back lady's mantle plants in spring instead. As with Russian sage, removing lady's mantle foliage late in the season will make the plant's roots more vulnerable to winter damage. Number 11, coral bells. Coral bells bring colorful foliage to borders and send up clusters of flowers in spring and summer. While you should deadhead spent flowers to encourage more blooms, the leaves themselves should not be heavily cut back in the fall since they help protect the plant's crown throughout winter. It's best to wait until spring to prune the plant if needed, also removing any parts that have died in the winter. Finally, number 12 on a list of 12 plants you should never cut back in the fall, milkweed. Before you take pruning shears to milkweed in the fall, think of the butterflies. As a native perennial, the plant's foliage and flowers help support birds, bees, and butterflies. Its foliage is a particularly important food source for monarch caterpillars. In fall, leaving your milkweed standing provides shelters for pollinators that make nests in hollow stems. Also from BetterHomesAndGardens.com, the 4 leaf raking mistakes most likely to annoy your neighbors. An etiquette expert weighs in on how to handle the messy neighborhood issue of fall foliage cleanup by Miranda Crowell. Sure, good fences make good neighbors, but with fall comes proof that nature doesn't care about property lines, as wind often carries leaves from one home's trees all over the neighborhood. So what is the etiquette around leaf cleanup? Can you ask your neighbor to rake your lawn if their tree is the one dropping leaves? Is it okay to rake leaves into the street? If you allow your leaves to remain where they fall in your garden beds, will your neighbors hate you? We talked to etiquette expert Elaine Swan about how to handle the messy business of falling leaves and keep up good neighborly relations. First, not offering to clean up after your tree. You can't control where your tree drops leaves, but if a significant amount of foliage is winding up on your neighbor's property, you should offer to clean up after it. It's really important to make sure that you talk to your neighbor and acknowledge what's happening in nature, says Swan. When approaching your neighbor, Swan suggests offering to help in some way, be that raking their yard when you're cleaning up yours or bagging the leaves for them. Even if your neighbor says they're fine cleaning up the leaves themselves, they'll likely appreciate that you acknowledge the situation and offer to come up with a solution. 2. Confronting neighbors over their leaves. If your neighbor's leaves are ending up on your lawn and they haven't offered to clean them up, it may be tempting to talk to them about it. But Swan says if you want to maintain a good relationship with your neighbors, it's not worth it. It might not technically be your problem because it's someone else's tree, she says. But sometimes, in order to keep the peace and keep your own dwelling beautiful, you can yield and say, you know what, I'm going to let this go and just clean them up myself. If neighbors' leaves are really driving you crazy, Swan suggests approaching them politely in person and with a helpful, not confrontational tone. You might say something like, I notice that your leaves are starting to pile up. Is there anything we can do to help? She says. Number 3. Placing leaves in the street. You should never rake or blow your leaves into the street gutter. First off, leaf litter can clog storm drains. Plus, if wind picks up, the leaves can wind up all over the neighborhood, irritating your neighbors. By moving leaves into the street, you're creating more of a problem, says Swan. And don't count on street sweepers to clean them up, as wind can move the leaves around before they get there. The one exception is if your municipality offers a curbside leaf vacuum collection service. Typically, only bagged leaves are accepted as part of yard waste pickup programs, but sometimes loose piles of leaves are accepted. In these cases, leaves were often required to be piled in the right of way rather than the street gutter to minimize mess and clogged drains. And number four, letting leaves pile up on your lawn. A growing leave the leaves movement encourages gardeners to let autumn leaves remain where they fall rather than raking and bagging them. It's an ecologically sound idea. Decomposed leaves benefit the soil and wildlife, but a front lawn full of leaves might not thrill your neighbors, and if you're in an HOA, might even violate neighborhood rules. If you want to allow your leaves to decompose naturally in your yard, however, there is a happy medium, says Swan. Move the leaves off the front lawn to a tidy pile on the side of your house or backyard. That way you can allow the natural processes to take place while staying in step with your neighborhood, she says, or place them in a compost bin. You can also run over leaves on your lawn with a mulching mower to shred them into smaller pieces. Provided your leaf layer isn't too thick, the smaller pieces will settle down into the grass and become less visible while still providing soil benefits. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called Just Keep Planting. It was written by Adam Kahn, and there's a quote here from John F. Kennedy. The great French Marshal Leoti once asked his gardener to plant a tree. The gardener objected that the tree was slow growing and would not reach maturity for 100 years. The marshal replied, "In that case, there's no time to lose. Plant it this afternoon." Just keep planting. Long before Paul Rokitsch was born, a copper smelter was built amid the lush trees and grasslands of northern Utah. The sulfur dioxide that poured out of the refinery turned the beautiful Ochre Mountains into a desolate wasteland. One day when Paul was 14, he showed another boy around his birthplace. When the young visitor looked at this wasteland and saw that there was nothing living there, no animals, no trees, no grass, bushes, no birds, just 14,000 acres of black and barren land that even smelled bad, well, this kid looked at Paul and said, "This place is crummy." Paul knocked him down. He felt insulted. But he looked around him and realized the boy was right. Paul made a decision. He vowed that someday he would bring life back to this land. Years went by, but Paul didn't outgrow his dream. Now a young man doing construction work, he went to the smelter office. He asked the company bosses if they had any plans to bring the trees back. "No," they said. He asked if they would let him try to bring the trees back. "No," they said again. They didn't want him on their land. Paul realized he needed to be more knowledgeable before anyone would pay attention to his dream, so he went to college to study botany. At the University of Utah, Paul met a professor who was an expert in the state's ecology, but the expert told Paul that the wasteland was beyond hope. "Your goal is foolish," the professor and his colleague said. "Even if Paul planted trees, and even if they grew, the wind would only blow the seeds 40 feet per year. That's all the dispersion he would get," the expert said, "because there weren't any birds or squirrels to spread the seeds further. And the seeds from those trees would need another 30 years before they started producing seeds of their own. Therefore, it would take about 20,000 years to revegetate that 6-square-mile piece of earth." "It would be a waste of your life to try to replant the ochres," Paul's teacher said. "It just can't be done." So Paul tried to go on with his life. He got a job operating heavy equipment, got married, and had some kids. But his dream would not die. He kept studying up on the subject, and he kept thinking about it. And then one night, he stopped worrying about the so-called unattainable goal and began seizing the smaller opportunities right in front of him. That night, under the cover of darkness, Paul sneaked out onto the wasteland with a backpack full of seedlings and started planting. For 7 hours, he planted seedlings. He did it again a week later. And every week after that, he made his secret journey into the wasteland and planted trees and shrubs and grass. Most of them died, but many survived and grew. For 15 years, he did this. When a whole valley of his fir seedlings burned to the ground because of a careless sheep herder, Paul broke down and wept. Then he got up and kept planting. Freezing winds and blistering heat, landslides and floods and fires destroyed his work time and time again, but he kept planting. One night, he found that a highway crew had clawed up tons of dirt for a road grade, and all the plants he had painstakingly planted in that area were gone. but Paul just kept planting. Week after week, year after year, he kept at it, against the opinion of the authorities, against the trespassing laws, against the devastation of road crews, against the wind and rain and heat, even against plain common sense. He just kept planting. Slowly, very slowly, more and more plants took root and spread. Then gophers appeared, then rabbits, then porcupines. Nature was coming home to the ochres. The administrators at the old copper smelter eventually took notice of Paul's work and gave him permission to keep replanting. Later, in the face of political pressure to clean up the environment, they actually hired Paul to do what he was already doing. They gave him machinery and crews, and his progress accelerated. Today, this former 14,000-acre wasteland is filled with trees and grass and bushes, rich with elk and eagles. And Paul Rokich has received almost every environmental award Utah has. He says, "I thought that if I got this started when I was dead and gone, people would come and see it. I never thought I'd live to see it myself." It took him until his hair turned white, but Paul managed to keep that impossible vow he made to himself as a child. Paul Rokich planted a wasteland, and one tree at a time, it grew. That's called Just Keep Planting, written by Adam Kahn, one of the many stories that make up chicken soup for the gardener's soul. And that's a Green Thumb Show for this week for Sun South Radio. I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.